Howdy, folks. Today we're talking compressing time with the undisputed lord of the time lapse himself, right after this. Welcome to Camera Shake, where we bring you the insider scoop on all things photography and videography, giving you a unique opportunity to stay ahead of the curve. As always, I'm your host, Kirsten Nutz, and before we get into it, I've got one thing to ask of you. I've noticed that over 65% of our viewers on YouTube and listeners on audio are not actually subscribed to this channel. But you can help us out by hitting that subscribe button. It'll help us get even more amazing guests on the show, although I'm not sure if that's even possible, but yeah, might as well give it a shot. It's just one click. It'll take a mere second. Thank you so much. Now, without further ado, let's give it up for today's special guest, the time-lapse photographer, creative YouTuber, and educator, and as far as I can tell, the first Belgian we've had on the show ever. Give it up for Mr. Matthew van der Put. Matthew, man, how's things?
Things are good. Thanks for the intro. Nice to be here. Belgian-Australian since a few years ago. But yeah, I don't know many Belgian-Australians or Belgians, I was going to say, actually, doing a lot of creative stuff. So it's nice. It's nice to be there.
Yeah, I don't know many Belgians.
It's very small country. A lot of people, it's nice when someone asks me, like, where are you from? I'm like, I'm Belgium. And they're like, oh, from Flanders? What's it called? Whatever. I'm like, wow, you know enough of the country to know that we're split in multiple parts. And it's always a very contentious topic of conversation with fellow Belgians. But yeah, small country. I lived there my whole life until I was 23. And then I moved to Australia because I met a girl, fell in love, quit my job, moved over there. That was 10, 11 years ago almost. And we got married 3 months ago, so things are going well.
Oh, wow. And now you're in London, is that right?
And now we're in London, yeah. So I loved Australia. I loved living in Sydney. My career was going really well over there, doing all things time-lapse and hyperlapse. But then my then-girlfriend was like, I want to live in London for 2 years, she said, at the time. That was 5 years ago, so we've been here actually coming up to 6 years. So yeah, time's flying. Obviously, we lost a little stretch of time there with everything locked down, but making up for lost time now. And yeah, London's fun. Living in Europe's great if you like traveling. You can do the old city trip here and there. I visit my family in Amsterdam and in Belgium quite a lot. So yeah, it's good stuff.
Amazing. Now, time-lapse photography, that's a super interesting subject. Some of the listeners and viewers on this channel will probably know that I recently made a little time-lapse instructional video for PlanetPod. And as I was doing that, I came across your work and it really absolutely floored me because, you know, as somebody who's like, I guess like a lot of photographers, you know, somebody who has dabbled with time lapses, but never really got into the nitty gritty of it. I saw your work and it, like I said, it was amazing, absolutely incredible. So give us sort of a helicopter view of how you first got into making time lapses.
Firstly, thanks for the kind words. Much appreciated. I've been doing time-lapse photography, or I've been creating time-lapses for, I think, since 2010 or 11, something like that. I was in film school at the time, and the thing that triggered it for me, because after a few years, I analyzed, like, where did this actually start? And I realized that it started before the moment that I'm about to describe to you. But the moment that really, like, brought it home was watching a film on Vimeo, when I was still watching stuff on there before the company took a bit of a turn. It was called The Island by, I assume he's Scandinavian, Terje Søriert or something like that. I don't know how to pronounce his name. But it was a video of one of the Canary Islands. And it was your standard beautiful, like mind-blowing time-lapse video with astrophotography, the Milky Way, inverted cloud formations, fog rolling against mountains. Everything sped up. I was watching this and honestly, jaw hit the floor. Didn't know what I was looking at because I found it was just visually so impressive. The saturation, the elements, the stuff in the sky, sunset, sunrises, all these things. And I'm like, and I knew how to make videos and I knew how to shoot photos, but I'd never been conscious of the technique of time-lapse photography where you use a photo camera and high-resolution raw photographs to create super high-quality video files. So I always call myself a bit of a hybrid shooter because, you know, my input is photography, my output is video. That video triggered it for me. I Googled, well, I went through the comments and the description of that video trying to find out what is this? What is it shot on? How does this work? What do I need? Can I do that? And at the time, I had a Canon 600D with just your stock firmware, but I was Googling how to time-lapse with that camera. I landed on Magic Lantern, which I assume a lot of your listeners are familiar with, or maybe not, depends on how young or old they are. A custom firmware that you can load on the SD card of select Canon cameras, and it enabled you to shoot time lapses without a remote. Shot my first time lapse that night on the Nifty 50, the 50mm 1.8. It was a sky shot because I started shooting it at night, and I just got immediately hooked. I haven't stopped shooting since. I've since turned it into, it's gone from a hobby to an obsession to a career that has taken me all over the world and has allowed me to work for, you name it, whichever big brand I've maybe, possibly worked for them, visited many countries and continents and shot for many cities. And it's still a hobby. I still enjoy shooting it as a hobby. I have that my view here in London is an incredible view of the skyline. And if the sky is nice or if the clouds are interesting, you'll catch me on my balcony with one or two or three cameras, still shooting stuff, not to share it per se, just because I like doing it and I like seeing what the sky looks like when you speed it up, and I like seeing what everything looks like when you speed it up, which is what time-lapse photography is, you know, capturing stuff and then making it move faster.
And the incredible thing about that is it really reveals something about the world that it remains hidden from your bare eyes. You know, normally that's the interesting thing.
I look at it as a looking glass in a sort of a different dimension. Looking at that technique, it gives us visibility on our environment from a different perspective. How clouds move, how cloud systems or storm systems or air interacts with different air flows, different humidity levels in the sky. You can have a storm front hitting a city and having an updraft from buildings, that affecting how the clouds move. But if you shoot people on a crossing, looking at Shibuya crossing or people coming out of a station, if you shoot that with the right settings and the right shutter speeds and interval, you can see how organic everything moves and how it's all fluid. Everything's a fluid pretty much. And that's the fascinating thing. It's this looking glass. We can't see it. We can't witness it with our own eyes. So we use technology and hardware and software to reveal these things. And, you know, other stuff is how the color in the sky changes, how different layers of clouds get lit up with different colors from different frequencies that get absorbed differently through the atmosphere at different times of the sunset and the sunrise, all these things. We don't know that it's there, but when you shoot a time lapse, you get a glimpse in this hidden world.
It's super interesting. I remember doing some very simple time lapses off the River Thames and all the boat traffic that's happening on there. And I was watching it back afterwards. I'm thinking, I didn't realize boats turn like that.
Yeah, they're kind of like drifting, and it's fun. And then you see how, there's different currents and stuff in the river. It's funny, and this is come through my career as well. Like when I started doing time lapse as a hobby, what we were talking about earlier, I told myself, and it's weird that it's coming up now because I remembered this earlier this week. I'd kind of forgotten it for a few years. I remember when I started doing time lapse as a hobby and got really, really obsessive with it. I've got a bit of an obsessive personality. I remember saying to my family, and friends, I don't think I can turn this into a career or into paid work, because looking at how much time and energy and money you spend on getting to a location, setting up a couple thousand pound worth of gear, waiting there for a few hours, then going home, then offloading it on expensive hardware to edit with expensive software, all this work, hours and hours of days and days, and then you end up with a 10-second video. Like, who in their right mind is going to pay for that? I remember saying this, but I managed to do it. When I moved to Australia, I decided to give it a red-hot crack and found the right people with the right vision and the right budgets. And that led to a very fulfilling career. It's just, you gotta find the right people to make it into a career, I guess.
And I'm guessing you didn't necessarily start out with, like, you know, tens of thousands of pounds worth of camera gear. Like, how did you first get started in terms of gear? Did you just use, like, your regular Canon Revel or something of that?
Yeah, it was the, I think it's the Revel XTi for the American audience. It was a 600D in Europe or in Belgium at the time. Started with that, had a couple of lenses, bought a secondhand L lens, my first red ring, you know, very exciting. A secondhand 17-40 f4, the, I want to say Mark II version, or maybe the Mark I, I forget. It was pretty old, but it allowed me to shoot wider. That was my first L lens, but the lens that came before that was a crop sensor lens, because the 600D, of course, is an APS-C sensor. It was a Takina 11-16 2.8, which when I eventually upgraded to a 5D camera, 5D Mark III, you could still use that 11-16, even though it's an APS-C lens. From 16-14 mm, you get a small amount of vignetting, but you still had that wide angle available that covered the sensor. And I think after that, I got the 17-40 f4 because I wanted sharper images. Then I slowly started expanding to another 5D3. I think at this time I was living in Australia and got to know through Abraham Joff, who was one of my first, one of the first directors, I guess, to take me under his wing to shoot stuff. He had a great relationship with Canon Australia. I got to know those people. They got me some jobs. They got me some work. Some of the jobs I got paid in gear. So eventually I ended up having another 5D3, another 5D3, then a bunch of 60 Mark IIs, I think. I just expanded, like, I kept on expanding. 24-105, great all-round lens. 70-200, f2.8, ISUSM Mark II. Very great lens. Great memories with that one. And then just, yeah, kept expanding to the point that I just had so much kit. I still have a lot of kit, but I've downsized a lot since. But, yeah, just slowly snowballed into a large amount of equipment. When I was living there, my office, which is the equivalent of this, but it was a different setup back then, had a wall with all these shelves behind me, and I had all of my kit just spread out on it, all the boxes, little trinkets, but lenses, cameras. I used that as a storage instead of a trolley like I have behind me now, or other shelves or boxes. I just had it all on there. It was a wall of gear, and a lot of my viewers from the early days would still remember how that was and how ridiculous it was to have so much gear. But I didn't use the majority of it, because when I was doing a lot of my time lapse and then eventually hyperlapse work, I made the most of it. I'd be shooting, you know, 3-4 cameras at the same time, flying a drone on the side, doing some Snapchats when we were still Snapchatting and all that. So, yeah.
Because you're also running a YouTube channel at the same time. That's the other thing. So you have to create content for that. Continue.
Yeah, I've got a love-hate relationship with YouTube. I've been on YouTube since 2007. That's the age of my channel. So the issue with that is that the channel is so old that a lot of my followers, which currently is sitting at around 72K subs, I think, a lot of those people are from different timelines or from different times in my YouTube career, if you can call it that. Some of them started following me because I was doing travel vlogs. Some of it was random cinematic with quotes videos. Some was silly stuff. Some was eventually started, you know, becoming time lapse and tutorials and then editing tutorials. But all those different subjects had a different following. And now I've got this jumble of people. And I think when I post a new video, I think this is what's happening, because my views are generally quite low. Because I believe when I post a video, it gets spread out to, or seeded out to, a number of people that are spread out over all those interests. If 2/3 of them are no longer interested in time-lapse or a tutorial and they don't engage, it's not going to help the algorithm to push it out to more people. So I've played with the idea of starting a new channel a lot, but I don't think I can be bothered. I've had the channel for so long. I've been uploading on it for so long. I've got everything nice and set there. It's a really hard thing to walk away from. So I just keep trying. And my latest thing now is to do YouTube Shorts, which I posted a video yesterday, got a decent amount of views, then I like, let's do it again today, and then it just absolutely bombed. So, I don't know. I keep trying, pretty much.
It sounds like a very recognizable, you know, situation. But it's the same thing, really. You know, this podcast goes out on YouTube as well as, of course, across virtually all YouTube audio channels, if you want, or audio platforms. And YouTube really isn't necessarily, it's not a native home for podcasts of this length, you know, an hour and a half plus or whatever. And so, you know, it's a very similar thing. Like, the way that this podcast performs on YouTube is in no way comparable to the way it performs on audio. And so I've been thinking about, what am I going to do with the YouTube channel? Am I going to like add instructional videos, for example, or, you know, stuff like that, or gear related stuff or whatever. And I had exactly this, I followed the same sort of path of thinking as yourself, where I was thinking like, oh, maybe I should set up a new channel and just start over and like focus it on that. And so right now I've just come back to the realization that actually screw it. I'm just going to, this is the home. So, you know, I'm just going to carry
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Also, just like from a practical point of view, I have a lot of links out on the internet, stuff that would link back to my channel, subscribe links, all that kind of stuff from the last, you know, 15 years or more. I don't know how to redirect, firstly find all those and then redirect all those. It is the home of me. I think I'll just keep trying shorts and maybe eventually I'll break through the algorithm, but also I find it often a bit pointless to worry about algorithms, because I see this on Instagram a lot and then people on TikTok, and people just complain about the algorithm constantly. And I don't know, just, you know, make stuff that you like doing. If you're lucky, people will find it. If you're lucky, you have an audience that will keep looking for it. But just, yeah, don't write too many angry tweets or threads about how the algorithm's doing your disservice. There's literally no point. Like, what's going to happen? The algorithm's going to read your tweet and going to change?
And also, you know, ultimately, you know, when you're putting the work in into making, you know, a video, like your videos are really interesting, you know, and obviously you put a lot of work into them. You know, and the same thing is true for like making a podcast episode or whatever. You know, there's time and effort and so on that needs to go into it. If you don't really like doing that, if you're only just chasing the views or the subscribers, then I think in the long term, we're talking years rather than weeks or months.
There's no longevity there. That's another realization I've had. I took a little break at the start of the year or end of last year. Obviously, went to Australia, got married. That took up, you know, a lot of time and effort. And it took me a while to get back into it. I always use the start of the year to kind of look and work on my business as opposed to in my business, see what my goals are, what I'm going to be working on, etc. And then I was like, oh, it's time. It's really time. I really should make another YouTube video. And then I sit myself down and I start working on it. And I post it. And as soon as I sat down, even though it took me so long to sit down again, as soon as I sat down and I finished it and I uploaded, I'm like, oh, I really love this. I really love this process of making videos, not necessarily for YouTube, but I do have a soft spot for it because it's always been the ultimate social media platform for me, even though for a long time, and maybe even today still, people don't really see it as social media, even though it is maybe the most of social media because you really get these parasocial relationships with other creators. But I just love it, and I don't think I'll ever quit. And that's the thing, if you don't love it, you won't have that longevity. You won't be able to do it for a very long time. That's something that reflects in that as well. Is I've been thinking of the idea of restarting a podcast or starting a new one. I started one years and years and years ago. Filmed a few episodes, posted one, and I was like, whatever, moving on. Because at the time, I was trying too hard. And now the idea of me restarting or starting a fresh one, I had this whole idea and this concept. I was like, no, you won't be able to keep going with that. If you're going to do a podcast, it needs to be the way that you are. And it would be me with my mate who just sit down and take it easy and chat about all things photography and careers in photography and how to make money and all that kind of stuff from a creative career. But it has to be us, because otherwise you won't be able to keep going for 199 or 200 episodes like you've so incredibly have done, which is so impressive, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I mean, the thing is, it really is, you know, I love doing it. That's ultimately what it is. You know, I started it with a friend, and then after about roughly about, I'd say, 100, just over 100 episodes or something, you know, when everything came back to normal or went back to normal, you know, then I think he felt that he had to go back into, you know, work a full time, and it became, you know, it became a difficult workload. And at the time I thought, I love doing this. I'm not going to stop. You know, I love having these conversations. And the interesting thing was only earlier today, I got tagged in a story on Instagram with somebody's obviously been listening to the podcast, and then sent me a message, and she said, I love the podcast. I learned so much. And I thought, well, that's why I'm doing it. And actually, that's really why I'm doing it, not only for the audience, but also because I learn a lot. Like, I learn a lot from talking to you about time lapses, right? Or talking to Joe McNally about lighting or whatever. Like, I have learned so much as a photographer.
No.
Not only as a photographer, also as a human being, actually, you know. That I think that I, you know, I wouldn't be where I am now just in terms of skills, you know, if it hadn't been for this podcast. So I always call it my own personal university, you know. It's much better than any university course because I can talk to anybody and ask any question I want. It's brilliant.
It's just a really big win-win that you're describing here because you're getting something out of it. You've obviously got a very great situation, like operation going on here with how easy it is and how the layout and everything. So it's easy for the guests. The guests get the exposure from your audience. Your audience gets the knowledge or the intel or the whatever the value from the guest. It's just a value increase for everyone involved. And that's the lovely thing. That's a very nice thing to be able to do. If you can monetize that properly and have that going either full-time or on the side, that's just, yeah, it's great. It's very inspirational.
Exactly. And the monetization thing, you know, is something that has sort of started to happen over time, but it really wasn't like, completely was not a motivator in the beginning. In the beginning, the motivator was literally, you know, so we were talking before we went on air, the motivator was literally just not going insane during the lockdown.
I was about to say that. Probably like just trying not to go absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
To be honest, I did the same thing, except I did my Cloud Palace live streams on Friday afternoons, because I'm a very social guy. I like going out. I like, you know, living in London, I like going to the pub, or living in the UK. I guess that's the thing you do, right? Except sadly, it's gotten so expensive lately. But I couldn't do that anymore when everything was shut down. So I would just buy all these like niche beers and taste them on stream on YouTube while reviewing the clouds of the week. So I had, obviously I've got the view and I would have camera set up all week long just to capture the clouds, and then I would render them. And then on the stream on Friday afternoon / evenings, we would just stream and have fun and talk shit with the chat in the comments. And I'd try and plan all these things, like do a stream from the balcony and have my phone linked. I was still on Android at the time, so I was using all these obscure apps to sign into my OBS remotely. And then one time, because my view that you can't see here, it looks down to the BT tower, which is a big telecommunications tower, and 2 days of the year the sun sets right in the middle through that tower. So I planned it all out to be able to capture that on the stream, which was very fun. And then it was cloudy, but then I did it again the next day because I'd misjudged the timing as well. So there was no monetization plan there. If anything, it was probably really bad for my channel, because people subscribe that aren't really interested in me. I keep seeing these live streams pop up every Friday. I'm like, who's this idiot? What's all this about? I don't care about that. Unsubscribe. What it did do is strengthen the bond with my community, with the people that were, you know, just hanging out, 20 to 50 people every Friday, just watching this guy geek out over the sky and clouds and how it's all liquid or fluid dynamics happening right above our heads that we're not aware of. But there was no monetization there.
There's a lot of stuff that was going on during the lockdown. Like I remember starting a Zoom, like an open Zoom thing where I was teaching different aspects of Photoshop, for example. And I just thought, like, you know, I've got fun doing this. You know, if other people can join in and learn a thing or two, then fantastic, you know, let's do it. But really just gave me an opportunity to hang out with a bunch of people and drink a lot of beer whilst I was doing it. So, you know, my editing skills were sort of getting a little hazy.
Yeah, there's some live streams where I'm like four beers in. I'm like, oh, I've got to eat. I'm getting pretty loopy. Yeah. I mean, I just call it, like, all right, guys, I'm off. I don't want to be drunk on stream. So,
I remember looking at the screen one time and going, like, did I apply blur to that, or is that that's just my eyes going funny?
The open group, was that like just to join any time? The Zoom, was it on Zoom yet?
Yeah, it was on Zoom, like when everything was on Zoom basically at the time. You know, it was basically I just put out a time and a day. I think it was a Wednesday evening sort of a thing, 7 p.m. or whatever. And I just put it out on social, and you know, whoever wanted to join in, I put the Zoom link on there, and whoever wanted to join in and learn some Photoshop or whatever, then they'd be welcome to just join in, you know, and I would just go through a particular project on Photoshop, you know, whatever the topic of the week was. And I would just teach people how to replace skies, or how to color correct things, or like whatever, how to retouch skin or whatever it may have been. Of a redo was just a different thing. And
something I was also always wanted to do on the live streams, but the issue was I was running an older MacBook at the time, high spec machine, but just wasn't good enough to do it while live streaming with the screen and everything. Plus, the issue with time lapses is you're dealing with thousands of raw files versus one photo in Photoshop that you're applying whatever masks and effects on and drawing on it or whatever. To quickly demo what you're doing in a time lapse, it's just not a thing because you're editing 1,000 photos at the same time. Then you've got to save all the metadata, export it or import it in other software, and then render it. And that often takes 10 minutes to an hour. So the process of that is, it's almost like cooking shows where you got to prepare the renders beforehand and then pretend that you're editing or actually re-edit them all to the point that, and then you have the file that's already been rendered the day before ready for the camera for the live stream. That's maybe how I could have solved it.
Exactly. I mean, for those viewers watching this now, as this is going live, which will be a couple of weeks after the photography show, but since we're recording this a few days, almost a week before the photography show, I'll be teaching how to easy edit video for podcasts on the production and editing stage at the photography show. So this would have already happened. But basically, so I can reveal my secrets now, I guess. So who cares? But yeah, in order to edit a whole like 2-hour podcast episode in 30 minutes, that's really not really going to happen live on stage. Plus, there's rendering times and all the rest of it. So what I've done is I've got my good friend David Bergman has agreed to come on and record a 5-minute, excerpt of a show, including the intro and the outro and a little bit of chatting in the middle. But I can then take that 5-minute example and edit it in exactly the same way as I would edit a standard episode, but I do it on an iPad because it's all about creating an easy version of it. And if I can get this whole episode done whilst I'm sitting on the couch, I'm sold. Hey, let me just jump in real quick to tell you about the amazing sponsor of this episode, Platypod. Platypod offers innovative camera support systems designed to unleash your creativity. With their stable, versatile, and portable solutions, you can capture stunning shots like never before. And I'm not just saying that. As the host of the Camera Shake podcast, I can personally vouch for Platypod's incredible products. They've become an integral part of the show. In fact, I'm surrounded by various Platypod products holding up lights, cameras, microphones, and so on. It's really helped to transform the way I make the show and the way I shoot at home in the studio and on location. But don't just take my word for it. Explore Platypod's website at www.platypod.com to discover their range of products, including the Platypod Extreme, Platyball tripod heads, and the brand new handle, of course. Make sure to follow Platypod on Instagram and Facebook at Platypod Tripods for exclusive updates, tips, and giveaways. By choosing Platypod, you're not only investing in your photography, but you're also supporting the Camera Shake Photography Podcast. Thanks again to Platypod, our amazing sponsor. Platypod, where innovation never sleeps.
Yeah, that's something I'm not sure how to deal. Again, it has to be, if I'm doing the podcast soon, it has to be doable to... I don't want the post-production side of things to block me from doing anything. Like, oh, I don't want to record because it's going to take another 2 hours of editing. So I'll be very interested to try and get some knowledge off you, hopefully at the photography show or from some other recording somewhere, to figure out the best workflow. That's something I always like doing. I recently redid my whole office and I've got a different lighting setup and my microphone here, etc. And then I can just spend days and days and days just testing and figuring out if anything needs to change or, if it's easier, if that clamp is over there or if this little cable hanging thing is over there.
Man, workflow is such an important thing. When Nick decided to leave the podcast, it was, before that, when we first started, we had, the way we had it set up is basically that I would do the pre-production, do the planning, I would get guests on the show and everything else. And then he would do the editing. And then afterwards, I would do the promotion on social and so on. So it's pretty much, I think it's 50-50 roughly. But then, of course, when I continued doing it on my own, I then had to do everything myself. So now I had to do everything that I was doing before, plus all the editing and everything. And that very quickly turns into a massive ordeal,
Yeah, and if, so you said, because you say slowly on, your monetization has come in and has worked, but if you're doing that from the start with no real clear vision of when money's going to come in, that's just such a ball ache. So you really have to love it. You really have to be doing it for, because you love it, or because you love how the community responds to it, etc. So
And you know, I mean, for me, it was like, you know, at that point, I was at a point where, you know, I guess I managed to get some really interesting guests on, and I kind of thought, like, I've given the opportunity to have these conversations with those people and learn from them. I mean, I'll be doing this for free, 100%, definitely. But really, it was all about reassessing workflows. There was one particular moment actually, where I was chatting with Frederick Van Johnson, who does the This Week in Photo podcast, and we were talking just offline, you know, and I was like, I think I was recording everything on Zoom at the time, and I was complaining how it would take me about like 6 hours or something to all in to edit an episode, right?
Gosh,
and he was like, yeah, and he was like, I don't know why you do that to yourself. It takes me 20 minutes. And I'm like, how do you do that? 20 minutes?
What were the key takeaways? What were the key differences?
Oh, the key differences was that he used Ecamm, basically.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and the thing was like, so everything that I would do manually afterwards, you know, in post, all the like cutting.
Like transitions and stuff. And
yeah. And like, you know, cutting from one speaker to the other, you know, for instance, if it's like me speaking, I could cut to myself, or, you know, I can put you in a frame, or I can basically have both of us on the screen. You know, that I would do afterwards. And so I would have, I mean, it was just like, and when you're editing a 2-hour episode, you know, just imagine how
much. Yeah, because you got to have everything synced up and.
Yeah.
Now it's, yeah.
And so, you know, I sort of thought, well, this isn't happening. But of course, when it comes to Ecamm, for example, I'm able to literally live edit it. I can just decide when I want to cut and that's it. And so my output basically is that's the video file, that's the podcast. And I really just have to bookend it, put the intro on, put the outro on, you know, put some images over the top or whatever. I mean, all that kind of stuff's relatively straightforward. And so, you know, create a template file that has everything sort of pre-made on there. So it just saves me a ton of time. And of course, the other thing was, so Nick, who I started the podcast with, was also an audio engineer. So he took care of all the audio editing. And when Adobe Podcast came around, when they, you know, they bought Shasta, and then, you know, now they're enabling you to do basically audio enhancing via AI. When that first came out, I thought, like, I'm going to give that a shot. And I have to say, over the last sort of 8 months or something, that has really come on amazingly. So my audio workflow is, I was going to upload it into there, and I'm downloading it again when it's done, and that is it.
And just the audio track, you put that in there, it treats it nicely. You re-download it in California.
Yeah. So even, for instance, you know, imagine like if both of our audio levels are slightly out of, you know, out of whack, it will flatten everything out. It will compress nicely. In the beginning, the compression was really harsh, but they've now you can now basically reduce the amount of processing that you want on it. So you have like a percentage slider, you can slide it back, or, you know, wherever it sits comfortably. It takes care of all the background noise. It takes care of the EQing and everything else. So really, all I do is I whack the audio file through that, re-import it, sync it, and then apply a limiter setting that I've created a preset for that, which just brings the audio levels to exactly where I need them. And that is it. And it literally, the beautiful thing about it is, whilst that takes a few minutes, you know, to happen, I can do other things, you know, and actually, so I'm not losing time. I'm not waiting for that to cook, essentially. It just does it.
Yeah, you're trying to be as efficient as possible, because if you're doing that on a lot of apps, you've got, you know, a lot of time adds up. That's something I've always focused on, in both from the, since it was a hobby to when my time-lapse photography became a career, is efficiency. Specifically because you're working with so many files from multiple cameras over multiple days for whatever project, you know, what's the fastest way? And oftentimes it's just getting a faster computer.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I mean,
but this is the
software. Thing,
talking about time lapse, it's like, you know, I remember when I dabbled with some time-lapsing years ago. I mean, you really had to like get in there and do a lot of manual stuff. And of course, now, first of all, your iPhone can create a pretty decent time-lapse right out of the, yeah. out of the gate.
Yeah.
But what is your sort of post-production process? Like once you've filmed the time-lapse itself, what's your sort of process after the fact?
Totally depends on what is shot on and where it's going. I've had clients, or last week I wrapped on a shoot. Hopefully you'll see the results of that on TV in the next few months, which will be fun. Can't talk about it now. But they needed the absolute highest resolution possible with everything, like all the data, nothing could be compressed. So instead of going from a workflow where you reprocess stuff multiple times for hyperlapse, for example, we make sure that your raw files get turned into the correct video codec and resolution and everything from the raw to that file directly, so they can put it in their pipeline. Other people I know would do raw to an intermediary or a proxy file to then do another edit and then export it to video. But every time you compress, every time you export files, you lose quality, you lose data. And if your production's of a certain scale or quality, you can't be doing that stuff. But generally, say I shoot a time lapse. Let's talk two scenarios. One is just a daytime shot of the sky, of a cityscape, shot on a DSLR or a mirrorless camera. The other scenario will be where we have a day to night transition, like a sunset or a sunrise, either way. Scenario one, it's daytime. I've got my camera set up and I'm shooting 300 photos at a fixed interval, say every 3 seconds, and I'm capturing a raw photo every 3 seconds via a remote or built-in an intervalometer that triggers it. You end up with 300 photos that are all on the same exposure because you shot it manually. That's the way you do it in manual mode. I then load that onto an SSD on a solid state drive or internally on my SSD. Generally, you don't work with spinning drives. That's very slow and yeah, just bogs you down when you're working with big sequences. That gets loaded into Lightroom Classic. Again, this is just one example of many potential workflows. So Lightroom Classic, where I import that whole sequence and I color grade one of the photos that then gets synced to the rest of the sequence. And then I save the metadata of that edit. So exposure changes, contrast, vibrant, saturation, curves, whatever. All of that gets saved in a so-called side card file and .xmp file next to your CR2, CR3, RW2 files. So your raw files get a little buddy next to them in your Explorer or in your Finder. You need that little side card file because when you then load that sequence into After Effects and set it up so that it exports into a video file, After Effects will read the edit that you've done in Lightroom Classic from that side card file. Otherwise, it will just render out a flat look of the preview that was in the raw file. Or it doesn't render at all because it doesn't know what to read. Depends on your settings, etc. But generally, raw to video, and the video has a built-in color grade already because you've graded it in Lightroom Classic. That is one way you can do an edit. What I often do if I'm shooting, like if I'm on a time crunch, I'll shoot raw and JPEG. And if it's not needed that it's the highest possible quality, I'll have the raw file stored somewhere, but I'll just export the JPEGs using an app called Glue Motion, which is free and a paid version. It's just a really simple interface. It's really efficient. It's really quick to just quickly render out some sequences. You don't always have to open up After Effects and wait for it to load, etc., and use a complicated interface. So that's the basic time-lapse where the light stays the same. If you have a time-lapse where the sun is setting, obviously your light's changing. You need to adjust your exposure. Otherwise, you're going to get really dark photos if you're starting daytime going into full night. Depending on if you have a smart camera, and with smart camera, I mean, it'll gradually change the settings as you're shooting, as you're capturing the light. It knows that it has to ramp the settings slowly over time, not from one photo to the next so that it gets all flickery. If you have a smart camera, you don't have to do too much editing. You can follow the same workflow that I just described. If you don't have a smart camera or an older camera, you have to manually adjust your exposure throughout that sequence. So you end up with a little zigzag pattern as the sun sets in your brightness value of those photos, of that photo sequence. You can remove that or you can level out that brightness zigzag with a software called LR Timelapse. And I just mentioned you can level out L and ramp your settings. That's what it stands for now, level and ramp time-lapse, LR time-lapse. It used to be called Lightroom time-lapse because it was a side software to Lightroom, but I think there was a trademark issue there, obviously, in the name. It is incredibly powerful software, and I've used it for almost since the start that it came out. What you can do with LR time-lapse is you can de-flicker your footage, which is another big issue with time-lapses. If you started out with time-lapse at one point in your life, you've probably landed on an issue where your footage is very flickery. The brightness goes up and down per frame. That's because cameras generally aren't made for time-lapse. And if you have an aperture, if you're shooting at f11, every time the photo clicks, the aperture closes, but it doesn't close hyper accurately. It doesn't close exactly the same. So there's micro fluctuations in your aperture blades between photos. If you're shooting a series of portraits where your model is moving positions, etc., you won't see that brightness change. But if you're shooting the exact same frame under the exact same conditions, 2 seconds apart or 3 seconds apart, you will notice that micro fluctuation in the amount of light that hits the sensor. So that is the brightness flickering that you can remove with LR time-lapse. You can remove that zigzag brightness from your curve. You can change your white balance from daytime to nighttime throughout the shot. So like sequentially, it spreads out the change. You can adjust your crop. You can do all these exciting things in LR time-lapse, like long-term time-lapse capture editing as well. And it works now with the new version. It works by itself, or it works alongside Lightroom Classic. So it's, yeah, the beginner stuff, you can go with free apps, or some cameras render in camera. Then you can go Lightroom Classic and After Effects, and then there's LR time-lapse and After Effects. That being said, DaVinci Resolve has a version. I've made quite a lot of videos about all these softwares that you'll find on my channels. But with DaVinci Resolve, you can do everything for free now as well. There are just certain limitations, and it depends on the camera brand that you have, depends on the RAW file that you have, etc. All of this I've talked about on multiple tutorials and written blog posts and videos, and in my time-lapse course as well. You'll find all that. But yeah, it's like, you know, how long is a piece of string? Or you can ask, like, what's the best way to shoot a model? It depends on the situation, what you're after.
Exactly. And of course, you know, there will be, for those listeners who's interested, that all the links will be in the description, obviously. So you can check out Matthew's YouTube channel with, like I said, there's a plethora of super awesome videos on it that really go into absolute detail with anything time-lapse related. A lot of cameras nowadays, a lot of like relatively recent cameras have time-lapse settings built in. Is that something you'd recommend if somebody wants to like get started with time-lapse? Is that useful?
Yeah, definitely check out what the camera has built in. I think Sony calls it, or maybe Nikon calls it intervalometer. Lumix calls it time-lapse. I'm on the Lumix system now. Half the reason for that is because it's the built-in time-lapse features are incredible. Time-lapse and stop motion, and for hyperlapse photography as well. It has these features that are so incredibly useful. That really shows how much the brand thinks about what do professionals need, and also what do beginners need to shoot time-lapses. But yeah, check out the menus or just Google, you know, camera brands, time-lapse, how to. If it's Canon or Lumix, you'll probably end up on my website or on my YouTube channel. I haven't made too much content about the other ones. But the majority of cameras have something built in now. If they don't have that built-in feature, go on wherever you are, Amazon, B&H, or Best Buy, and just put in your camera name and intervalometer or time-lapse remote, and you're likely going to find a remote that's around between 15 to 25 USD or euros that will allow you to trigger a photo every 1 to 60 seconds, something like that. And you can use that to get started. That's how I started after I moved on from Magic Lantern with other cameras. Those remotes are so affordable. They're very reliable. And they open up, you know, a whole world of fun of shooting time lapses.
And Nikon, if you are a Nikon shooter, Nikon do this thing where you can set your intervalometer. But also there's a time-lapse function where it then takes those images and it bakes them into a video file. So just for the sake of super simplicity, you can then just basically create a
video. I've got some tutorials on the Lumix channel. It's an Nikon does it and Lumix as well. You can choose like the playback speed, the resolution, the frame rate, all from the RAW files that are in the camera. That's something I wish Canon did. And I've asked them this years and years ago, please add this functionality, because this is the beauty. You can shoot RAWs and JPEGs at the same time, have the camera render a 4K 50 frame video file in camera so that you can quickly preview what you've shot, show it to a client or whatever, or use it as proxies for an editor. You just don't have that on Canon. And that's part of the reason why I moved to the Lumix system, because it does have that. And Nikon's getting some good PR lately. I think it's, was it this week or last week, depending on when you're listening, probably a while ago, that they bought out Red. I think all of a sudden Nikon's going from the not so cool as far as image goes. I don't really look at it that way, but they've changed their image a lot, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, they're making that transition from underdog to dog.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, yeah, underdog in the sense of like all the cool street shooters. Like if you look at people that are always like hyping up Sony and that, even though they really don't like Sony, but they've somehow managed to capture that youthful, you know, urban city shooter, travel vlogger, cinematography, whatever. And then there was Canon because they had the good colors. And then the underdogs like a Fuji or a Lumix. Nikon was like on the same level as them as far as sales go, I think, and quality of product and what professionals use. But they've never really broken through to that younger crowd, I find. I mean, the amount of memes that are out there about how Nikon is weird, is silly. Just to clarify, I'm still brand agnostic. I used to be a big Canon guy. But then I found out, you know, or I realized if I'm going to be making content for the whole audience that is about time-lapse photography, I can't just limit myself to one brand. So started making content about more camera brands. That being said, Lumix just stands out for me as far as the hardware and the software. But you can shoot great time-lapses on any camera.
Right, Matthew, I know you have to shoot. It was amazing to have you on the show. I'm sure we're going to continue that conversation, especially because there's so much to talk about when it comes to time lapses, but also hyperlapses, which isn't really something we've sort of dived into in this episode, but we will do in the future. And seeing that you're not actually that far from me, you're in West London, is that right?
East London.
East London. Okay,
so shortage area. Just had a shortage.
Other side of town for me, but still not far. So I'm sure, you know, a pass will cross in town at some point.
Yes, definitely. So, let's go shoot and grab one of them beers we were talking about earlier.
Oh, 100%. Definitely. Again, Matthew, thank you so much for being on the show. Amazing.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Excited to check it out and check some other episodes.
Okay, folks, that's it for today. I've been looking forward to having Matthew on the show for a while now, so it's been awesome to finally make it happen. And as always, before we go, let me just recommend another episode that I think you'll like. Check out episode 187 with Russell Preston Brown, where we discuss the future of photography. I'm sure you'll love it. If you enjoy our content, consider supporting us on buymeacoffee.com/camerashake to help us continue creating and bringing you more exciting episodes. And I have no idea why I keep saying us, because it's really just me. So there you go. It really does mean the world to me. And for those of you who are listening to the audio version of this podcast, did you know that there is a fully fledged video version over on YouTube with plenty of examples for our guest photography in full Technicolor? All you have to do is go over to YouTube, search for Camera Shake Podcast, and you'll be able to watch all past episodes on there. If you're already on YouTube, drop us a comment, hit the like button, ring that bell, and share with your friends. Your engagement helps us reach a wider audience all over the world. Thank you for listening and watching, and remember, new episode drops every Thursday, so make sure you mark that in your diary, calendar, whatever you use. Until next time, keep shaking things up in the world of photography. See you next Thursday.